From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, Joyce Carol Oates' new novel, The Sacrifice, is loosely based on the real-life case of Tawana Brawley, the African-American teenager from New York who gained notoriety in the late 1980s when she falsely claimed to have been gang-raped. Going beyond the 25-year-old headlines, Oates engages readers in contemporary dialogue about race, sexual abuse, and the nature of truth. And she'll join us to talk about her book and her prolific career. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Joyce Carol Oates joins us in studio for this morning's second Forum hour. Her newest novel, The Sacrifice, is based on the 1987 Tawana Brawley case involving a young black woman who falsely claimed to be imprisoned, raped, beaten, and left in a garbage bag by white police officers and a white assistant district attorney. Distinguished professor of humanities at Princeton and now teaching at Stanford and author of over 40 novels as well as a number of plays and novellas and many volumes of short stories, poetry, and nonfiction. Joyce Carol Oates has won many awards for her writing, including the National Book Award for her novel Them, two O. Henry Awards, the Penn Malamud Award for Short Fiction, and the National Humanities Medal. And we welcome her back to the Forum program. Delighted to have you back.
Thank you.
I'd like to actually begin by mentioning that there was a recent incident, and I mean, this is based on a Tawana Brawley story, and I want to get into the novel and maybe even get into the research that went into sort of going back to that story. But there were two things that happened in the news today. There was a Department of Justice report on Ferguson, which said essentially that the police had been doing too much racial profiling and essentially acting in unjust ways. And there's a video that's gone out, it's gone viral, of a black man, homeless black man in Skid Row in Los Angeles who was shot to death by police. Circumstances still kind of misty as they often are in cases like this, but apparently the argument was that he was trying to take a gun from the police officer, and there were a number of police officers, and that they tried to taser him unsuccessfully. But it seems to me that although your novel has been getting a lot of coverage in terms of the Tawana Brawley case, it's also about police brutality, and police brutality plays a very central role in this where a black population is concerned.
Yes, I think that's really the general theme of the novel, what I think of as a kind of toxic cloud of racism in the country. It's invisible to most white people. Most white people, I think, are not racist, but we don't really see the racism of police and law enforcement officers who are paid their salaries by our taxes. So that's the irony.
Yeah, you've almost suggested that white people, in their ignorance or their neglecting this, are perhaps even complicitous, because a lot of people are going to jail and lawsuits are settled, and there's that lack of vision or awareness about what's going on.
Well, it's very sad and very upsetting because hundreds of millions of dollars are settled in lawsuits every year because of police misconduct, not necessarily always against black people, but homeless people, the mentally ill, and just ordinary citizens. So hundreds of millions of dollars of our tax money goes to settling these lawsuits. So in a sense, we are enabling racism and or police incompetence or brutality. We're not doing it deliberately. We don't even know that it's happening, but there it is.
A couple of years ago, you came out with a novel called The Accursed, I mean, which was also sort of in the world of race and racism and very concerned with that. And I'm wondering if this is – I noticed that Henry Louis Gates gave you some good words in this new novel and said that you seem to understand what W.E.B. Du Bois said about the problem of the 20th century being the problem of the color line. Maybe the problem of the 21st century in America is the problem of the color line. But race has become singularly important to you in many ways. I should mention Skip Gates had his own problems with the police. But
yes, yeah. That's right. He did. Yes.
But this
yes.
has become sort of a central motif for you, hasn't it?
I think it's such a profound issue in our life in America. And I'm really fascinated by the relationship between the races. It goes back to when I was about 12 years old and went to a city school for the first time. and had was in an integrated school and had friends who were at that time called Negroes. This was a long time ago. So it was a whole new world for me and very exciting and thrilling. I had lived in the country, but I could see that these wonderful young people, these friends of mine, that they came from a certain part of Lockport. It was called, literally called Lower Town. It was literally Lower Town, and there was Uptown and Lower Town. And I could see, though I had not the word for it, I could see the segregation in that society and in that community. But I didn't have the words. I was only, actually I was 11 and then 12 years old. So that made a strong impression on me. And when I write about Black people today, I'm really writing about my emotional ties to these children with whom I was friends in 6th and 7th grade and 8th grade.
Chris, you know the old argument that for white writers to step over and get into the minds or the inner lives of characters that they create who are of a different color is, remember the old Nat Styra, Nat Turner, William Styron conflict about him suddenly being criticized because he was imagining himself as a black slave, Nat Turner.
Well, I guess it's a matter of one's perspective. Some people believe in a kind of identity politics where you can really only speak for your own self, your own skin and your own economic level or your gender. Other people feel that the imagination is broader, that we can be sympathetic with others, and writers and artists can take on other identities. Naturally, I believe the latter because I've always been interested in writing about other people. I very, very rarely write about myself. But there's a sense of territory, maybe, that some people don't feel that white writers should write about a territory that they don't actually live in or that they haven't lived in for any period of time. But I think it's because I had these friends when I was quite young, and I have even dedicated one of my novels to one of the boys I knew, like in eighth grade. So I felt very close to them. And in writing about them, I don't feel that I'm writing about anything exotic or strange, but really a part of myself.
Well, you've also, I want to get into the novel, but written about a personal experience you had in a car that was being driven by a black man, and they were stopped by the police, and he was really hassled, I guess is the only way to put it, and there were no cell phones then, and that had quite an impact on you. I mean, in the fact that he was moved separately from you. They didn't want you to be there, you felt, because they didn't want a witness. I mean, that was what your intuition told you.
Yes, that was really scary. I was very, very scary. And when I think about it, I sort of clutch up, you know, because there seemed to be nothing I could do. And I was actually physically afraid. It doesn't sound as if I was very courageous. I was going to step outside the car, and this state trooper yelled at me, New Jersey state trooper. He said, "Stay in that car, lady." It was so loud and so, you know, domineering, and I stayed in the car. What if I had gotten out of the car? I can't even imagine what might have happened.
Well, but that had an impact too, I imagine. I mean, because you did write about it, and the whole Tawana Brawley case set your imagination on fire again. What was it that drew you to that? I mean, it's back almost a lot of people's minds. It's associated with primarily Al Sharpton. And you have a character he's a prototype for, we can talk about. But it was a hoax and probably overplayed by the media to a great degree, and suggesting that you can't necessarily trust young black women or young black people who make charges against the police. I mean, it had a bad effect, just like people who are Holocaust deniers have a bad effect on those who really go through a Holocaust.
Well, that's true. I think I wanted to write about it from the point of view of a young black girl who really is sexually abused in my novel. She really is beaten. She has to go to the ER. The real Tawana Brawley had nothing wrong with her. She thinks she may have been taken to the ER, but they found nothing. And I did some research into the New York State Grand Jury special report on the Tawana Brawley case. So basically, it was a hoax. But I didn't want to write about a hoax. I wanted to write about a real event. I think that the media seized upon what would seem to have been a fairly implausible situation to almost obscure the fact that really, in real life, young black girls and women and for that matter, white girls, are frequently sexually abused and beaten and frightened and threatened with their lives. And the media will seize upon a hoax in a way to discredit the more legitimate and many more of these legitimate instances. I'm not saying that the media at that time, the New York Times, was very prominent. I'm not saying that there was anything calculated about it, really. But it has that effect. The media will seize upon something that's then revealed to be a hoax, almost in a way of discrediting or ignoring the legitimate claims.
We're talking with Joyce Carol Oates, author of numerous works, including Them, for which she won a National Book Award. And she'll be teaching at Stanford this spring, and she'll be appearing March 25th at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. Her new novel is called Sacrifice. And name your protagonist, a 14-year-old girl, in this with the name of the prophetess.
Yes, Sibylla.
Sibylla, why?
Yes. Well, many of the characters in my novels have names that are somewhat symbolic. And so one is supposed to think that maybe the character means more than just herself.
It's also what we associate with allegory, right?
Yes. Names like that. Yes. I should also say that one of the reasons I wrote the novel is that I had lived in Detroit in 1967 at the time of the so-called Detroit riot. And I wrote a novel called Them from the point of view of a white family in this inner city. I had always wanted to return to writing about an inner city experience from the point of view of a black family. So this is what The Sacrifice is really about. It's about a black family that disintegrates under the sort of relentless pressure of white racism, basically. The novel doesn't say that explicitly. I think if you read it carefully, the sort of prevailing sense that these people have of being harassed and never really being able to walk along the street or even drive along the street without the fear that the white law enforcement will harass them in some way. And then the men in that world are really emasculated. If they stand up to the police, they may well be beaten. They could be shot. But if they give in and they're very meek and conciliatory, then they've sort of lost their dignity. So it's not a situation that is really very healthy in any way. So I just wanted to write about that. The Tuana Brawley case was an example of a tabloid phenomenon, and I wanted to write also about the phenomenon of tabloid scandal.
And this was, you're mentioning the Detroit riot. In some ways, this book goes back to the Newark riot in 1967.
Yeah? Absolutely. The neighborhood is still in ruins after that. It's very much like Detroit. The Detroit and the Newark riots were around the same time.
And there's also a sense of, in fact, the stepfather as a character, not a very admirable character, to put it mildly. In fact, a brute, really, and very difficult. And not endearing man, but still what comes across, and it's always true of so many of your works, is trying to understand a kind of cause and effect, trying to understand the circumstances and the exigencies which create sometimes bitterness and unhappiness and violence.
Yes, well, a kind of secondary effect of racism, which we're perhaps not that aware of, is that a person who's a victim of racism goes home to his family, and he has been emasculated, he has been harassed, he's feeling really, really angry, really exhausted. And my character, Annis, also has arthritis. He's been working on a sanitation truck, and he's actually physically a wreck, and he's not even that old. But he goes home, and he's confronted with his family. And that is where the secondary racism erupts in violence against one's own family, what we call domestic violence. It's very often, I think, a consequence of the primary racism out on the street. The person comes home. He doesn't behave well toward his own family because he's been sort of broken down.
There's a story in Dubliners that's right out of that.
Yes, you know? You're quite right. Yes.
But there's also... There are characters here that are strikingly nuanced and multidimensional, complex characters. Even the Reverend is somewhat of a complex character. I mean, a lot of people would see a character like this. It's funny, the line that came to mind was what Gore Vidal once said about Tom Hayden, of all people, that he gave opportunism a bad name. There's certainly an easy way to see that with the Reverend you create and his brother capitalizing on this event. But at the same time, you draw him with a broad brush.
Well, I thought it was a sort of interesting figure. In literature and art, we have figures called tricksters, the trickster figure. And Reverend Mudrick, based loosely on Al Sharpton, not literally but loosely, is one of these figures. You wouldn't have a character like Reverend Mudrick or, in fact, Reverend Sharpton. They wouldn't really pop up in our culture if there wasn't the establishment. At the time that Sharpton came along, Giuliani was mayor of New York, very, very conservative, very right-wing, very Republican, completely pro-NYPD. There wasn't any shot, no matter how many shots a police officer might shoot against an unarmed black man, Rudy Giuliani would always support the police. So Sharpton comes along in reaction to that. I think that's fine, but also beyond it being a sort of moral, a moral necessity, it's something that happens in nature. It's the trickster figure erupts when you have an establishment that is dishonest.
I'm thinking about all the trickster figures rapidly coming to mind here and so forth, and normally don't necessarily think of them in terms of social circumstances, but indeed the point is well made here. You know, you have empathy for most of these characters, not the ones who are brutal, obviously, but I remember having conversations with you about how important the imagination is of the novelist to be linked to empathy, and, you know, you've been getting strong marks on that score. There was an article in The Guardian that spoke glowingly about your empathy. I have to get your response to this, Roxane Gay. I asked myself, did she read the same novel I did in the New York
Maybe
Times?
Maybe not.
Well, not only said, you know, that you had no empathy, but that your understanding of working class and black characters was almost out of an encyclopedia. And here you've been talking about these young people that you came in contact with at an early age and so forth. How do you respond to that kind of a review, or how does that affect
well,
you?
Well, I think that she just actually didn't read the novel. I think she felt that this was her territory and that if another black woman had written the novel, I think it would have been fine, or a black man. I think because I'm a white woman, it was a review written from that perspective of identity politics.
But she's white herself.
Is she white?
Yeah, she is.
Oh, well,
I believe Roxane Gay is white, yeah. But she still might have felt you were invading a territory that you shouldn't
well,
have.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know anything about Roxane Gay. I thought that she was black. I mean, I have a novel. There's a novel of hers on a shelf of mine, which I have not yet read. Okay, well, I might be mistaken about that. But people do get bad reviews quite often. I mean, I've gotten many negative and hostile reviews. So there may be a reason for any one of them, but it happens often.
Well, what you do with these characters, though, and it's, I remember once you're describing yourself as fascinated by the psychology of characters and the complexity of characters, and it comes across here because you've got, well, for example, a black teacher who is really kind of condescending and looks down on her uneducated the uneducated blacks in her hood, while the fact is she gets very angry at the school board not employing black women full time. And you have a Hispanic police officer who, Inez, who is, again, looks down on people in her community, but also wants to be seen as apart from affirmative action. And there's a kind of what Ian Forrest would call roundness of character.
I don't think they look down upon these people. I think they're trying so desperately to have a place in the society. You know, the Hispanic detective thinks to herself, well, my family owns their houses, and some people in my family have gone to college. It's more like a desperate stratagem. I mean, it's not anything that you and I would probably say. It's not that she's looking down on people. She's just really hoping to survive and keep going, you know. And then the teacher, she is a substitute teacher. She doesn't have the strength to go into her classroom and keep control of the black kids, even though she's black. She's just not strong enough. So she has to tell herself that she's better than they are in some way. But she's a touching figure, and I can identify with her. If I went into those classrooms, I'm sure that I couldn't keep order either. You would have to have a really firm grip on the situation, and I wouldn't be strong enough either. So I really identify with these people.
And let me correct something. Roxane Gay apparently is a black woman, so I had that wrong. Uh-huh. You had it right. And
I wasn't thinking that much about it. I just assumed from what she said.
Do you ever get writer's block?
I get writer's slowdown. Maybe it's writer's barricade, where I have to go around a barricade, or writer's detour. That's a new.
That's a good concept.
We'll just make that up today. It's writer's. It's not block. It's not a blockade. It's more like writer's detour, where you're detouring all around and in a circuitous route, and you don't know where you're going, and you hope you get back to the mainstream.
Well, I not only asked you that because of how prolific you are, but also I remember an interview I did with Edna O'Brien, the Irish novelist, who said every writer faces at one time the concern that the well that they dip into, there will be nothing there.
Well, I don't face that. It's the opposite with me. I don't have enough time to execute all the ideas I have, and many, many, many folders of ideas. And I actually work quite slowly, and I have to confess, I'm not proud of this, but my computer crashed a few days ago, and I'm in some state of high anxiety trying to retrieve some memory right in the middle of a novel. I'm not asking for pity or sympathy because
But you have both when your computer crashes or you're halfway through a novel.
Well, as my husband said, it's sort of my own fault because I didn't have backup. And I didn't have backup because literally, and please don't laugh, literally I didn't really know much about it. I don't know that much about computers. I sort of work on the word processor part of it, and I'm very naive about the machinery, and I didn't do all the things I should have done. Now my husband is saying if he had known that, he would have helped me, but I didn't even know that I didn't know.
Well, you'll have you have one of these genius IT people come out, and they can probably retrieve it for you. They can retrieve almost anything. We're talking to Joyce Carol Oates, and her newest novel is called Sacrifice. And let me invite those of you listening to join this conversation, talking certainly a lot about race relations and about the role of the police. And this has been very much in the news. It's in today's news, and you may want to join the conversation, or you may want to simply have one of your questions or comments for Joyce Carol Oates. She has many readers out there, and we welcome you and your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786, so please feel free to call us and join the program. Again, you can do that toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. You can also join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Do you mind also talking a little bit about some of your tweets?
Okay, if I can remember them.
All right. We'll hear from you when we return. Join us. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with novelist and short story writer and playwright and essayist Joyce Carol Oates, who was the author of many books and also recipient of many awards. She was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in 2000. She's teaching at Stanford this spring. She appears March 25th at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. And you are welcome to join us. We're talking really about her new novel, The Sacrifice, which revisits some of the themes and motifs as well as leitmotifs in the Tawana Brawley rape case. But it is certainly a fictionalized version and not necessarily in any way attempt to reconstruct that story, though it is certainly inspired by that story. You may have some memories of that, or you may simply want to join this conversation because we're talking a good deal about what we have talked about from time to time on Forum, and that is the concern that black lives do matter and the concern that the police are often acting in intemperate ways, even though there are clearly many good police officers who care about. In fact, Joyce, do you know Jill Leovi's book? It's about all of these murders that almost go unsolved in Los Angeles, particularly in the Compton area and that so-called ghettoized area. They're sort of, these are black people killing each other. The police don't do the work that they would do, you know, in a different class neighborhood and so forth. Yes. And she really documents a lot of this.
Yes, I've heard of that.
But she also brings to bear, some really hardworking cops who are who are on the side of the community. And
very interesting. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Well, I'm sure that's true.
It's complex, as we've said about so much.
It's complex. I think it's the unions, the police unions and the correctional officers' unions.
Well, again, we welcome your involvement in this conversation, and you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let's go to an Oakland caller first. Anne, hi.
Hi. So I think it's really great that you're demonstrating such dedication to racial consciousness as a white person, and as I've worked in a lot of different community settings and around diversity questions a lot in the 90s and early 2000s. And one of the things that I saw was that when it comes to acknowledging being the privilege, having white privilege, that's a great way to empty the room, that white people, that we tend to want to see ourselves in terms of exceptionalism. So we've had some kind of experience of, oh, my family was lower income, or my nephew is black, or something like that that makes us different. And then acknowledging sort of the breadth of what our class and racial consciousness is. And I feel like it's a really interesting place that you write from these associations in your youth, but it also seems like some kind of exceptionalism that could be perhaps like your really great racial consciousness could maybe be unpacked in a way that held more water for me.
Joyce?
Well, I'm not sure how to respond to that. Obviously, each person writes from his own or her own perspective. If I wrote about very wealthy people who were white, I would have to be imagining a good deal because I've never been wealthy. Or if I often write about men, and I've written about teenagers, and I'm far from being a teenager. It's just basically, that's what writers do. Science fiction writers particularly are making up many things. So it's just part of what we call art. I don't suppose I do any more of this than any other writer from, you know, Shakespeare to Euripides, to Balzac, to Dostoevsky, to Melville. Basically, is what writers do. Writers do try to imagine other people.
What about white privilege? Excuse me, Anne. I just want to ask Joyce Carol Oates about her notion of white privilege and how that fits into essentially the worldview that you have about race in America.
Well, white privilege is a new term,
and it's widely used.
I mean, it's a new expression. I mean, every person who is white would, I suppose, experience white privilege. It's hard not to have that.
It's often brought up, though, especially as, well, for example, I heard a story recently. I'll just give you the story and say what your response to it is about a young man who happened to be African-American who was menacing someone in a group therapy situation, and the therapist became very upset and agitated and didn't want to go back and deal with this young man again because he felt under threat. And he was told that he had white privilege, that he had to, in other words, factor that into his response. I mean, if you're threatened by someone, you're threatened by someone. There should be no color line, I would think, right?
Well, I think there are terms that become trendy. They become quickly cliches. I mean, there may be very, very right-wing American Nazi Party people who believe in white privilege as something that they deserve and that should exist. Then there are very liberal left-wing people who would feel that white privilege is something very embarrassing and that they should try to get rid of. But basically, it's something somewhat new in our discourse.
Is it privilege, though, or would supremacy be more white supremacy? That's more the boilerplate term.
Yes, that's true. White supremacy. Nobody would, I mean, except for the very right wing, would really even say those words anymore. It sounds ludicrous to even say white supremacy. White privilege would be something that's more unconscious, that when we drive along a street, we don't feel we're going to be stopped by the police just because we exist or because we're in a car, whereas a black person driving the same street might feel conscious that he could be stopped at the next corner and interrogated. So we feel white privilege only when we're made aware of it. Mostly we don't feel it. I don't feel as I walk down the street that probably the law enforcement officers will stop me. I've never felt that.
Anne, are you still on the line?
Yeah, I'm still on the line. And I guess the thing that I'm trying to kind of push on is that these things are really complex, and how we talk about race and how we as white people like really are responsible around racial positioning is a very nuanced kind of question. And, you know, I think the thing of how black people have always had to know more about white people because of power relationships. I think it's like totally, again, I think that it's totally a great artistic venture to be dedicating oneself to unpacking some of that. But I guess I just feel like in nuanced contemporary dialogue about race in very interracial communities like Oakland or Richmond, the kind of like sort of falling back on a childhood experience wouldn't really fully hold water. And I think it seems to me like you have a lot more, you're bringing a huge amount of integrity to it. And I would just like to hear it described.
Well, Anne, thank you for the call. Actually, I recommend you read Sacrifice. And
well, I've also written many, many novels and stories on the subject.
Yes. As I said, Accursed was 2013, so it's been recently a lot.
And I've also reviewed lots of work by black people. I think the call are just not familiar with my work. But I'll just say one thing kind of parenthetically, and maybe this sounds controversial, but racism is not limited to the white race. The first people who were selling African slaves were Africans. They sold, you know, neighboring tribes. They sold them.
And there were, we actually have a novelist scheduled later this week who wrote about a black slave who was purchased by the Creek Indians. I mean, he was bought, and he became leader of the Creek tribe, actually.
Oh, that's so interesting.
It's a real story, like you're using real story. I mean, it's historical fiction.
Well, there were black slave owners. It sounds bizarre.
Yes, there were.
There were not very many of them, but there were black people in the United States in the South who owned black slaves.
And here's Glenn. Glenn, join us. You're on.
Hi, thank you. Years ago, I read a book you wrote, and it was a book of critiques and analysis of great novels, for example, like War and Peace. What is your favorite great novel?
My favorite great novel? Wow, that's such a question. Well, James Joyce's Ulysses is a novel that I would go back to again and again and again before the beautiful writing, just the extraordinary vision of James Joyce and his language. And I'm sure Michael will agree with that.
Yeah, I'm also a Joycean. It's like standing up at an alcoholic anonymous thing.
We're both Joyceans.
Let me thank you for that call, Glenn. Except it's always very difficult, if not impossible, for me to answer that question. It's like people say to me, who's your favorite interview? I mean,
of course. It's like, but Joyce is he encompasses so much, you know. He's life itself.
Do you have, I mean, you ask novelists this question too, or they often hear it, you know, what's your favorite novel? And you've written over 40. Is there one you feel like, it's almost like asking, you're particularly attached to a child more than if you have many children.
Well, my most ambitious novel that cost me the most emotionally in many other ways is actually not about race at all, oddly enough. It's Blonde. Which is about...
Well, it was about your mother, really, wasn't it? About Marilyn Monroe, yeah.
Norma Jean Baker, who becomes Marilyn Monroe, who is of the generation of my mother. And that world, that lost world, lost America of that era. Yes, Blonde is very close to my heart.
Also, last time you were on, of course, we talked about... I want to get to more calls here and this conversation about race and so forth. But you had written a book about your late husband and going through... You know, the pain of being a widow and so forth. And a lot of people wondered, I suppose, what happened after that. And for those who are not aware, you've remarried and seem to be pretty happy in your new marriage.
Carrying on. My friend Gloria Vanderbilt said to me when my husband died, she says, Joyce, one breath at a time.
Good
That's
advice.
The best advice I've ever gotten. But you know, that applies to everything in life. You may have a day that's so filled with unhappiness and anxiety that you think you can't get through it, but literally one breath at a time will take you through it.
It says a lot more than the old one day at a time, doesn't it?
It's just one breath. You know, yeah. It's so small, and Gloria's had so many losses herself, and yet there's nobody more radiant and vital with life than Gloria Vanderbilt.
Well, I was also in conversation earlier over the weekend with Bob Haas and Brenda Hillman about spirit. Spirit is breath, you know. I mean, when we talk about feeling spirited or, you know, being full of spirits, I don't mean alcohol.
Yes.
There's all that sense of breath and life being fused
yes.
together.
They're wonderful poets. What a couple.
Yeah. It was a fundraiser. I was glad to do it. I had mentioned tweets, and let me just go to this because I want to get your response. You were given a lot of criticism about your criticism, I guess, about class differences vis-a-vis a video about women being catcalled. And you tweeted, isn't harassment of women walking alone in urban areas as men do freely and without incident a matter of neighborhoods? In New York City, certainly. That was your first tweet. And your second tweet was, be very surprised if women walking alone were harassed in affluent Midtown, New York City, Fifth Avenue, Park Avenue, Washington Square Park, etc. As the follow-up, were you surprised there was so much pushback on this?
Well, what I said was just common sense. And, I mean, it's de facto. I lived in New York, and I don't know what to say. People who are quick to take offense on Twitter, I think it's a transient thing. I doubt that they really care that much. I think it's something that they quickly type out and forget. I know I don't remember.
I think what they were saying was, you know, there's catcalling that goes on everywhere, or it's ubiquitous.
Well, it may be a different kind of, maybe even more sinister. I mean, I'm not saying that Bill Cosby, for instance, is the, you know, very symbol of all of this. But say Bill Cosby, I'm sure, never stalked or catcalled anybody, yet he's been accused of behaving very badly with women. Many, many women have accused him. However, he is not a visible stalker, and he doesn't catcall in any visible way. In the film, the video went viral. Everybody was making comments on it. And it seemed to me what I was actually saying was that men may be different in different parts of the city and that you just use your common sense. The girl's walking along, and she's dressed in a certain way, and there is a video recorder with her. It seemed to me that maybe they were setting up some of these scenes, you know, that I'm not saying that she deserved to be stalked or catcalled, but that they were doing it almost as a kind of theater. You know, you take one block way in downtown New York City, where there's lots of construction workers and so forth, and you walk along the street, and you're a good-looking young woman, and you have somebody with a camera following you, you're probably going to get some action that will show up on the video. You do the same thing up by the Metropolitan Museum of Art, you're not going to get the same thing. It's obviously not. It's just a matter of common sense.
Here's Nora from Oakland who writes, what is Joyce Carol Oates' research process? How does she prepare to write novels which address directly or indirectly actual events?
Oh, well, with The Sacrifice, as I said, it was sort of a mixture of having lived in Detroit, wanting to write again about a big urban, an urban situation at a time of civic unrest, and then reading about the Detroit riot. I had lived through it, but I didn't know that much about it. So my research went back to the 1960s, and then I read about the Tawana Browley case, and I live near Trenton, New Jersey. I go to Trenton, you know, fairly often. So a lot of this is just, you know, being walking around in a street, walking in neighborhoods and looking around. I actually went to Trenton several times to be on juries. I was called for jury duty, so you spend some time in this very very interesting city, Trenton, New Jersey.
There's a listener who writes, Joyce Carol Oates has said her early writings were very influenced by living in Detroit. What does she think of the recent struggles of that city?
Well, that's so fascinating. I follow that pretty much online. There's even a movie called Only Lovers Left Alive that's set partly in Detroit. It's a wild, brilliant, beautiful movie about two vampires who've lived for centuries, and one of them is living in the ruins of Detroit. Everyone should see that movie.
Have you seen that viral video that went out that had Hiroshima after it was bombed, and Detroit that same year, Detroit,
no.
The thriving metropolis, Hiroshima with all the buildings
wow.
destroyed.
Oh.
And then it came to the present and it was utterly reversed.
Oh,
Hiroshima looked like a great metropolis and Detroit looked like Hiroshima.
That is so fascinating. Now, that's something that went viral that I missed. It must have just didn't get around on Twitter where I was.
This is from Antoine, a very thoughtful email. He says, we need more people talking about race and their experiences with race. We need more people of other races to talk about race and racism. I think that there are those who think of themselves as not being racist, and they say that from the sideline. As a black man, I would speak up for any of my friends who are not black if it is ever needed.
That's very nice. Yes, I think the effect of the review of my novel by Roxane Gay was to discourage white people from even trying to write about race. She was really claiming that only black people should be allowed to write about it. I mean, in essence, that's what she was saying. So it would be very discouraging, but I don't think people should be discouraged. I think that's a wonderful comment that young man made.
And here's Dan, who writes, does your guest think that white authors are more trusted sources on stories about African-Americans than African-American authors? Did she find her novel readily accepted by publishers? Had she been a black female author, she would have had a more difficult time getting published?
Well, I don't think that's the case, no. I think the predominant American writer of our time in terms of literary achievement and recognition and popularity is Toni Morrison, who's a black woman writer.
And also a Nobel Prize winner.
Yes.
Ben writes, how does Ms. Soates choose how close to reality to write a book? Has she ever watered down the reality to make it more entertaining? Who are some authors she likes to read? These are kind of broad and maybe too general questions, and I think you've already mentioned many of the writers you like to read. But watering down reality, you're fictionalizing reality. Does that in your mind stack up to watering it down?
Well, it's an interesting question because, for instance, in real life, some people may be extremely profane. If you watch The Sopranos or long ago the episodes, Oz, people obscenities abound, you know, in many, many cable television programs. But if you're writing a novel, you may not want to include all those obscenities and profanities. So when I'm writing about this urban neighborhood in my novel, The Sacrifice, I don't have a language that probably would reflect the actual reality. And I think most people who are writing, not watered down so much as elevated or enhance it. I try to have people speak more poetically as they probably don't in real life.
David Simon got a lot of kudos for the ability he had of translating that language, a white guy, in The Wire. And yet, talking about profanity and obscenity, and certainly it runs rampant on HBO and Showtime. There are probably no boundaries. But, you know, Norman Mailer published The Naked and the Dead in the late 40s and could not use the F word.
I know. It's a matter of community taste.
We'll go to another caller, and that's Shannon. Good morning.
Hi, Ms. Oates. Years ago was given a copy of You Must Remember This, and I've been hooked on your books ever since. So I'm anxious to read the new one. And my question is if you can comment a little bit on your love of boxing.
Well, my boxing experience began with my father taking me to Golden Gloves fights and watching the Friday night fights when I was quite young. I was probably 10 or 11.
Brought to you by Gillette Blue Blades.
Yes. I can just see
Madison
that.
Square Gardens.
I can hear this, you know, Gillette. I can hear the gong ringing in the commercials. But I was very impressionable, and because it was my father, he had a real love of boxing. He knew a lot about it. And he was just sort of brimming over with enthusiasm, which just sort of washed over onto me.
We did an interview a while back with Mike Tyson. Did you ever meet him?
Oh, yeah. I wrote a lot about Mike Tyson. He's the boxer I knew best. So you interviewed him after his autobiography.
Right. Yeah. And he was doing it on stage, actually.
Undisputed Truth.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Very, actually...
fascinating, isn't
he? He is a fascinating guy. Fascinating. I'll tell you what happened when he was on, because this is kind of a fascinating anecdote. We had Max Boot on right after him, the war historian, who actually has a fascinating piece in the New Time magazine where he's defending boots on the ground against ISIS, and then there's somebody on the other side who's saying, no, can't make this mistake again of sending our men, women into this kind of harm's way. But it turned out that Tyson was a real aficionado of war history. He was kind of thrilled to meet Max Boot. And we didn't have much time, but he was peppering him with questions and wanted to spend a lot of time with him.
Yeah, Tyson's one of the most fascinating people I've ever written about. I interviewed him for Life magazine way back in 1986. He was only 19 years old, and he was already an extremely interesting person.
Well, as fate would have it, there's a tweet here from Roxane Gay. It says, my review of the sacrifice had nothing to do with my race and everything to do with my opinions on the writing and approach.
Well, fine. How can she separate the two?
She just has in a tweet. Let me go to another caller, and that's Jack. Jack, you're on.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Again, thank you for your body of work. You are a real American treasure. Question, the end of the novel question, of course. You mentioned Ulysses, and I suppose we can say you are a serious writer. Where is literature going? I don't know really of anybody, other than probably a few English majors, who are reading Ulysses and Ezra Pound and all the great stuff. Where do you think we're going with literature, and do people in your shoes, do you even think about that stuff at all?
Thanks. Well, it's a very complex question, and I don't really know how to answer that. Maybe some literature is preserved in universities and somewhat, quote-unquote, privileged areas, and maybe most people are reading 50 Shades of Grey or younger people.
Heaven help our civilization.
But obviously many people are reading that and they're not reading Ulysses at the moment.
Thank you for that call. Appreciate hearing from you. Can you talk about your character, the Black Prince, a bit? What the genesis was of that character?
Well, the Black Prince is someone that I want to say is fiction. Let me just say he's fiction.
But so, in other words, it came out of your imagination without anything spurring it at all, that character.
Well, I was following some of the real life, yes. But I want to be a little careful talking about that because there may be actual or historical origins of things that I have made into fiction, but it's not really up to me to draw a solid line. I mean, maybe dotted line.
That does happen, doesn't it? I mean, yes. Someone will say, I made this up completely out of whole cloth, and then there's a story in real life that parallels it or that is the same story even.
Well, my novel ends with a black man shooting two white policemen, and basically that's something that happened after the Eric Garner case just recently, just a couple months ago. My novel was written a couple years ago, so these things are probably ready to happen in the culture, and a writer just writes about them.
And you wrote about a character named Gerald Zahn, who was one of the police officers accused of the rape.
Yes.
So did that come out of the research, or again, pretty much full-fledged out of your imagination?
No, that's based on the actual research. When I first wanted to write the novel, I mean, a long time ago before I actually began writing it, I wanted to write about this young rookie policeman who is a white policeman, but not a racist. He's a white policeman who loved the idea of being a policeman. He committed suicide for personal and professional reasons, but not for any racial reasons. He committed suicide a few weeks around the time of maybe after the Tawana Brawley case. And so he was named as one of the rapists posthumously. And I remember reading about that, and I thought, that is so cruel to be accusing this man who has died. And how would his family feel? How horrible. How could they do this? Because, of course, it was just a false accusation. And he was the first person I thought of as the sacrifice. And he was the first person that I wanted to write about. And I wanted to write about his family, and I wanted to then conjoin it with the black family in an inner city. So it kind of all came together.
Brings up another quick question. We're running short on time here, but there's been a lot of criticism of the movie Selma because of the fact that, I mean, it does a lot to, at least engender a good deal of the emotion that went with that civil rights action and, well, the civil rights movement under Martin Luther King's leadership. But being toying with history, and the argument goes, young people will go away from that movie thinking that Lyndon Baines Johnson was complicit and opposed to the voting rights bill, which he was not, actually. But they had to set up a kind of bête noire for King.
I think that was at the dramatic terms. So yeah. There had to be a kind of foil. I don't know the literal history, but Lyndon Johnson is just coming off so poorly because of the Vietnam War, too. And he was such a great president, and he went so much against the grain of everything you would expect someone coming from Texas.
Yeah, I was just reminded of that because his family has been very upset about that.
Oh, it's sad.
As I can well imagine. Yeah.
It's very sad. It's very sad. And Selma's a great movie. I love the movie. I don't know why the screenplay couldn't have been a little more generous toward Johnson, because he suffered so much, so many consequences, so much backlash against him.
The director said she didn't want a white hero in the movie.
Well, he could have just been maybe, you know, a little less.
A little less, yeah. We're out of time. Thanks, Joyce.
Yes,
Joyce
yes.
Carol Oates, The Sacrifice.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.